This piece has been brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
This is Mike Edison, host of Art Senses a Seizure, as you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, please visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and happy Easter. Welcome to the main course on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Alexis McLaughlin, joined today by Kelly Jones. You guys may remember Kelly Jones from being on the show a few episodes ago. She was kind of co-hosting with us, but now we're going to talk to her exclusively about her history, kind of coming up as a chef. She got her start in Seattle, working under Maria Hines. She then moved to New York to work with Ashley Merriman. And most recently was working with April Bloomfield. She was the sous chef at the Spotted Pig, a well-known spot in the West Village, and also ended up the head of their nose-to-tail butchery program, which is kind of an interesting place. So, hey, Kelly. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Alexis.
Thank you for joining us on Easter Sunday.
Well, you know, it's a time to celebrate good food.
Yeah, good food, good times. You guys have a good start to your day? Out and about?
Yep, we got up pretty early. We went out to breakfast before, you know, the church crowds fill up every place. So that was pretty nice. We had a nice little American breakfast.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us. You were recently in Seattle, which is pretty cool. So that's where you're from, and that's where you started cooking as well.
Yes.
So now you're not at the Spotted Pig anymore. You've been doing, I know we're working together a bit with some recipe development, and you're doing some other editorial gigs. I know you got some kind of blog consulting in the works.
Yeah, so to cut you off right there, I have, you know, all the things that I didn't have time for before when I was working so many hours, I now have time to do now. So it's kind of a very happy time for me. I'm picking up projects as I go along. I know that when I first kind of got out of the kitchen, I was working at Rocka Chocolate, which was a really fun experience for me. That's down, their warehouse is down in Red Hook. And so that was really fun to see, you know, a food really come from, you know, a bean to an actual packaged product. So that was pretty cool seeing all that factory, the way that everything works and just how temperamental the chocolate is and just really learning about cocoa nibs and everything like that. So that was exciting. And then, you know, after that, I've been since working, like you said, working on recipe development and also getting excited to start some private dinner parties with one of my other friends. So a lot of exciting things to look forward to.
So busy, but not quite as busy as you are in the kitchen, because that's a demanding schedule. I can't even imagine.
I mean, it's very emotionally strenuous, I would say, and mentally strenuous, because I mean, no doubt I was a very active person. I've always worked out. I've always, you know, been on my feet for thousands of hours. But really, at the end of the day, it's like somebody can say something that just sets you off. So that's more the thing that I'm kind of enjoying, is having that peace of mind and, you know, oh, we're going to be late for this, or this isn't going to happen. And you're just kind of more relaxed about it. Whereas when I'm in my kind of my kitchen mode, it's like, what? You didn't defrost this, or you didn't have the keys for the car. It's like, it seems like a waterfall effect. So I'm enjoying the peace of mind for sure.
Awesome. I would love to hear a little bit more about your trip to Seattle. I know we have your wife in the studio today, Allie.
Yes, who's Allie, say hi.
Not excited to be on radio. She's the silent one in the corner.
Yeah, she's, I guess, modest, too modest for radio, maybe.
I have almost no experience in the Pacific Northwest. You guys are both from Washington.
Yes.
What's the food scene out there? What's the quintessential kind of Pacific Northwest, you know, vibe?
So the cool thing about the Pacific Northwest, and I really have noticed it in moving out here and then also visiting back home, is the people in the Pacific Northwest really are really concerned about, you know, just how, not necessarily the food or the drinks, but just how kind of everything, where everything comes from, and also if everything's delicious, they're not. I mean, people kind of, they get the stereotype as, you know, very active, you know, people that eat kind of granola and coffee, but really they like all the comfort foods. I mean, they like a lot of different kinds of foods. There's a huge Asian population over there, so we have really good Vietnamese food, which is something we don't exactly have in New York. It's a little bit fewer and far between. There's a really big Japanese scene there. I would say the most, the highest. So basically, Washington, the Asian population, the next highest out of the Asian population is Japanese also. So it's really interesting, you know, to see the variations on food there. You know, there's a lot of vegans and there's a lot of, you know, paleo diet people and lots of different diets that are a lot bigger of a concern. You know, I know that when I worked in kitchens in Seattle, it's like when you make family meal, which is just a meal for all the employees that work there, you have to take consideration into like vegan eaters, vegetarian eaters, nut allergies, all this stuff that, you know, in New York, when I made family meal, it's like, if you can't have it, you can't have it. You know, it's a lot more like, we don't have time for all your fake allergies or real allergies, whatever they are. But yeah, that's one difference in working in the food. But as far as like, one thing that I really love about the Pacific Northwest is the oyster scene. And that's something that is very explosive as far as eating oysters on the half shell. And a lot of people out there, you know, they go and they try oysters a lot. I mean, a lot of people have houses or cabins or know people that live on the Puget Sound or the Hood Canal. And, you know, there's a lot of oysters that, you know, are being harvested out there. So it's, I mean, there's a lot of different seafood. So I think seafood is definitely, especially oysters, is something I would really like to talk about. For instance, something that I thought was kind of crazy is you think about all the different kinds of oysters out there. I mean, really, there's only 5 actual species of oysters that we grow in the United States. And one of them, for instance, is the Pacific oyster, which actually comes from Japan. And that is harvested all over the Pacific coast. And basically, you can have the same species of oyster, but the different inlets and the different places you grow the oyster is going to determine the characteristics of the flavor, the texture, the shell, and the liquor, the juice inside the oyster,
so all that kind explains of things. Why when you order oysters, you're usually ordering from kind of like a site-specific?
Right. So it's basically like when you're ordering a French wine, it's like, you know, this spot, you know, Champagne region makes it like this and that. And they have really controlled specifications on how you grow the oysters. So basically the 5 species, just to go over it, we have the Pacific oyster, which is originally from Japan. We have the one of my favorites, which is the Olympia oyster. That is the only native Pacific Coast oyster. So Olympias is like, that's the only West Coast native oyster. And then you have the East Coast oysters. And then you also have the European oysters. And then you have the Kumamoto oyster, which is a special, specific type of Japanese oyster. That's actually a different species than this Pacific oyster.
So what are the characteristics that define and differentiate breeds?
So basically, well, the different species, I'm not quite sure how. I know that there's even more species that we don't actually grow in the U.S., but I'm not exactly sure how that evolved. But I do know that, you know, certain inlets and certain characteristics of the ocean really affect the flavor and how the oyster grows. For instance, like just out of basics, I mean, the Atlantic Ocean has a lot more, has a higher level of salinity than the Pacific Ocean. And the reason why the Pacific Ocean, you know, people say, okay, the West Coast oysters are a lot sweeter, they're more mild, they're less briny. And you say the East Coast oysters are more briny. And that's because, you know, you have all the glaciers and you have all the snow melt that comes down from the Olympic Mountains and the Cascade Mountains that feeds into the Puget Sound and the Hood Canal right there in the Pacific Ocean where a lot of oysters are harvested. And so that makes for a sweeter, less briny oyster. So really by studying where you're getting the oysters from, you can learn a lot about what their flavor profile might be.
Is there a name for the, you know, provenance, origin, point of oysters? Is there a Marwar? You like their, you know,
there's
their terroir.
There's some Latin names for the species.
But I mean, just in describing the region, or is that just not something that's really
considered?
You know,
they do it. They do it kind of by, for instance, I know that Beausoleil is a really popular oyster out here on the East Coast. It's actually one of my favorite East Coast oysters because, you know, when it comes to oysters, I would say, you know, I might get some snarls for saying this, but West Coast is definitely the best coast for me, for oysters specifically, not for everything, but for oysters specifically. I like the milder, more complex flavor. And so for instance, a really popular oyster from the East Coast is Beausoleil, and you can pretty much find that in all restaurants. It's a very mild, it's much more mild than the regular briny oysters, and that's because where it's harvested is actually New Brunswick, Canada. So up there, it's up there in very cold waters, and it's, you know, I think that they harvest them for about 4 years till they get to cocktail size. But up there in the cold waters, you have, you know, you also have Karaket oysters that are a little bit farther north than that, but that's about as far north as they go as far as harvesting oysters. But there's, since the water's so cold, it's a little bit less briny, and the oysters don't grow as big, you know. So let's say you grow oysters in Florida. It's got warmer temperatures, so the oyster is going to grow like three times as big in less time. So it's really like where you're getting the oyster. But Beausoleil is a good starter oyster. If you're going to go out to an oyster bar in New York, or, you know, I think they have them on the West Coast too, Beausoleil is a really good starter for East Coast oysters because it's actually very well balanced. It has a nice body to it, and it's got that brininess, but it also kind of has, I kind of call it a refined saltiness because it hits a different part of your palate. You know, you have a blue point and it's just kind of like right there you taste the salt, whereas the Beausoleil is a little bit, you know, it hits different parts of the palate. It's a little more refined and not quite so. It kind of has that champagne kind of yeasty flavor, like a fresh baked bread. So you get that kind of instead of a super irony. So that would, I mean, Beausoleil, I would suggest grabbing some champagne, trying some Beausoleils, and that's a really good starter oyster.
I gotta say, being from Florida, I'm a little bit partial to Gulf Coast oysters, and they're really hard to find outside of the area, but Apalachicola oysters are known, like they're really big. Mm-hmm. They're definitely like big in size. I've seen some that are so big, like you cut them into thirds just to have like normal, you know, expected portioning. But I never really thought too much about what is affecting the size of the type of the oyster. You just mentioned briefly that warmer water grows bigger oysters. Is
yes.
That, so is it the...
So like bacteria, if, you know, you have bacteria or anything that's growing, if it has a more conducive environment, it's going to grow a lot faster. So I think that, you know, with the cold water, I know with the Kumamotos and other, you know, Pacific oysters, they'll sometimes use the cold water to stunt the growth so that, like, the oyster will gain maturity and gain lots of extra flavors but won't be so big,
yeah.
You know. So, yeah, temperature definitely affects the oysters.
If you allow an oyster to, if you don't harvest it, will it continue to grow? Varieties and species kind of have their, you know, top limit?
I'm glad that you asked this question because this is, let me just explain how oysters live. I'm such a nerd. This is so exciting. So basically the way that the oyster lives is so this is what happens. So they have certain oyster farms where they mate the oysters and they produce the offspring, which is in like a larvae form. And what they do is then they ship that out to different companies, like Blue Island Shellfish is a big one out here on the East Coast. And, you know, Taylor Shellfish is the big one out on the West Coast. And they have all these little inlets and they put the larvae in the waters and, you know, the inlets and stuff like that. And then what they do is they cling on to a shell particle that's already in the water, and then they start growing based off that. So if you, for instance, if you tumble an oyster, you know, so like, let's take a really popular oyster is Kushi. That's a really popular, it's delicious, Pacific oyster. So basically what what you do is you put them in bags and you tumble them in the waves. And so the natural tumbling is what breaks off of the brittle ends of the shell. And that's how you get a hard, smooth shell. But what that also does is that kind of stunts the growth a little bit and makes them more plump. So instead of being long and flat, they actually get more plump because you're constantly...
It gets like a... I've had someone explain this to me before. It gets a deeper cup in the shell because you're almost... You're fracturing the shell in certain ways and you're forcing the oyster to put energy into fixing those fissures. And then, you know, that also makes it grow deep and kind of more, you know, like a sphere grow out than to grow wide.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. You're stunning, like you said, you're stunning the growth by fracturing the shell, and that forces it then to not be able to build as big and long of a shell and to be more compact. So it grows, you know, and if you think about the different, you know, forces involved, like from a physics standpoint, you're pushing the gravity towards, you know, it's almost kind of like a centrifugal force, like pushing the gravity towards the back of the shell. So then you get that deep cup, you know, just based on mechanics. Like ocean mechanics.
I would have never imagined that there was so much human intervention in like, you know, oyster farming and this and that. And they are really popular to farm. And it's one of those seafoods that, as I understand it, is not negative by farming.
You know,
are there concerns?
This actually oysters. Well, there were concerns. I know that, you know, oysters actually used to be native and they used to grow like the Olympic. One of my favorite oysters is the Olympic oyster, and that's the only real West Coast native oyster. It's just shy of an inch and a half. It's really small. They're very petite oysters, but they have so much complex flavor. And they basically used to run rampant, like all the way up to Alaska. I mean, you have different, obviously different flavors because of the different water, but it's still that same petite oyster. And basically they started with the Industrial Revolution, they started building mills and plants places. And so basically by the 1920s, I mean, you had all these polluted beds. I mean, the Hudson River used to have, you know, over 350,000 types of oysters growing in it, just wild. You know, it made up like a lot of the oyster trade, you know, back years and years and years ago. But the Hudson River was since polluted and can't, you know, hold oysters. But one thing that you were touching on is the ecosystem. Oysters really, once, you know, after the 1920s, they kind of cleaned out the water, especially over in Washington State. They really started being able to harvest more oysters there. And one thing that's great about it is if they filter the water. So basically a whole oyster's life is, as it's growing, it's basically just filtering the water. That's eating plankton, sucking in water, eating the plankton, eating whatever else out of it. And then, you know, the rest of the clean water passes through. So it's actually, oysters are very good for the ecosystem. So there's no danger in over farming oysters, you know, just that's the cleam the water is going to be.
Yeah, there's been efforts in, I know, down by Maryland and now up in New York and in our bays and waters here to introduce oysters back as a way to purify the water system and the pollution in the bays, which is really interesting. Just the idea that our intervention has taken this, you know, this kind of piece of the puzzle out and we really need to put it back to...
I mean, I think it's a brilliant idea because, and that's kind of something that a lot of chefs are touching on lately is how do we, you know, clean things up or grow things in a responsible way that really helps the ecosystem, you know, like us as humans.
Well, it's interesting because chefs have the opportunity to really drive trend by changing their menus and, you know, what they're focusing on. And so that is, you know, like chefs have a pretty large impact. If you start focusing on a particular type of food, how do you choose, you know, what you're going to put on your menu?
Oh yeah. I mean, you talk about, you know, Dan impact. Barber and people like that who are really set on, as far as, you know, like we're basically ruining all the farmland in California by just drilling down and getting groundwater that, which is miles below the surface. And it's like, that's going to be our groundwater for years to come. Yet we're taking it all out to feed these farms. And, you know, one thing that, Dan Barber touches on when he's talking about, you know, us not being so wasteful is, you know, using those rotational crops, not just using the beautiful crops that we want to use in our dream dishes, but also being creative and challenging ourselves to come up with dishes using crops like rye or different rotational crops. And, you know, we have the power to do that, which is very exciting. And that's something that I definitely want to do. I think reducing our carbon footprint is something we kind of have to start doing now.
Yeah. You know, an interesting story for me was actually Chef Mike Anthony over at Gramercy Tavern, now at Untitled. They started doing, you know, bringing in whole heads of cattle, like, you know, a side or a whole cattle to use in the restaurant. And if you guys, you know, aren't familiar, a whole steer is a lot to go through because you get maybe 17, you know, rib, you know, 12 ribeyes out of a side. Is that about right?
Mm-hmm.
Like 24 ribeye steaks, a few, you know, less than that filet mignon, of a whole steer, but you have the rest of, like, you know, 400 pounds of animal to go through. And what they did in the restaurant in order to be able to start that nose to tail program is they took the filet and the steaks off the menu and they introduced a meatball instead. And that was kind of what they did to drive the consumer choice, as well as, you know, that allowed them to get in head, you know, more like heads of cattle. And now they're going through, Patrick and I were just at Gramercy Tavern doing a little staff talk there. And Paul Wetzel gave us a tour around the place. And they're moving through six sides of beef in a month, which that is just, you know, an impressive amount for a single restaurant to
and that,
really
I mean,
be able
that's
to do.
Truly amazing, because definitely I would say, you know, the most sustainable cut is a grind of anything. And so, I mean, just, you know, always eat a hamburger if you want to eat a hamburger. Meatballs are awesome because it's just that's, I mean, getting a whole half of a cow or a whole pig or something like that, I mean, you're putting yourself responsible for using every part. And usually, generally, when put in the hands of a chef or a butcher, they feel that responsibility and respect to use every part of the animal. And it also boosts your creativity, too.
Yeah.
You know, everybody loves a good meatball, so you can't go wrong there.
All right, well, let's go take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk more about oysters and, I guess, Pacific cuisine with Kelly.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
Just your garden. It's the way you live. And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties, track and record your garden with photos and notes, share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow. With Bonnie.
Welcome back to the Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. We are joined with Kelly Jones, and we were just talking about oysters, Pacific Northwest food, nose-to-tail cuts, everything kind of under the sun. But to go back, you just got back from Seattle, and we were kind of talking about the food out there. Is there anything new in the food scene or restaurants and menus that you noticed while you were out there? Any changes? Because you've been in New York for some time now.
Yeah, you know, I noticed, I mean, there's always the same restaurants downtown, which are great. One thing I actually love about Seattle that I kind of miss when I'm in New York is Seattle's, it's like, they have so many happy hours that are so fun. They do deals on food, deals on drinks, you know, all those kinds of things. And so everything's like pretty well thought out actually for a happy hour, which is pretty funny. Because here, I mean, New York is such an expensive city. I mean, if you get 2-for-1 drinks, it's like, woohoo, you know, we're saving a dollar. But in Seattle, it's cool because, you know, everyone's into microbrews or wines or craft cocktails. So you can usually get a pretty good deal on microbrews and cool things like that when you go out. So I definitely miss that in New York. But, you know, my wife and I went up to Maine about a year ago, and they have a lot of cool microbreweries up there. One of my favorite is Allagash. I remember in Seattle, growing up there, we had Elysian Brewery, which was really cool. You remember? My wife remembers that. She's nodding. but yeah, that's in Capitol Hill, which is like Capitol Hill in Seattle is basically like the West Village of New York. It's kind of like the gay fashion scene in Seattle. So, it's a very like artsy, cool place to go check out. But one thing I want to touch on is, you know, I have two stereotypes basically of what people think of me in New York being from Seattle. And one of them is that I'm a crazy coffee drinker. And that is actually...
is that not also New York too?
I feel like it's very, very similar to New York. There's slight differences in the sense of people, I feel like, in Seattle, you know, they'll take the time. There's like a whole kind of coffee culture there. So, you know, people have their own roasters they like. They have, you know, certain coffee places they like. I mean, I remember I had certain coffee shops, but kind of the coffee culture over there is a lot more developed as far as people having the time to actually go to a coffee tasting. Whereas like here, I can't imagine having time to do that. But although I would love to go, you know,
I feel like New York is more about drinking, you know, deli and Greek diner coffee by the gallon.
Yes.
Whereas
the bodega coffee, $1 bodega coffee.
Seattle might be a little bit more interested in the roast and everything else that goes on.
Yeah. They, you know, just where the beans come from, and people are very, very concerned about that. But as far as, you know, and people will sometimes, you know, probably drink about the same amount of coffee as they drink here, but the people will kind of make a day or a night of it in Seattle. For instance, you meet with anybody. Like when I meet with my friends, let's say me and a couple of my other chef friends went out last night, and we wake up and we're like, we all just go to coffee together. It's just something we do. Where it's like, you know, in New York, I'd be like, do you guys want a coffee? Nah, maybe. You know, it's like, it's, you know, different people, different thing. But, it's, you know, there's obviously all different kinds of drinks. I see people ordering, you know, kind of like a French press or a macchiato or like different kinds of drinks in Seattle a little more often. And they have their specifics. And the people working in the coffee places are generally very fast, which is something that's different than New York.
The Northwest has really driven a lot of beverage trends in ways that I don't know what the impetus is behind that. But, you know, rogue breweries out there, they were,
you know,
there
there's probably a couple reasons. One being it's gray out a lot, so there's not a lot of sunshine, so you got to get jacked up. You know, the weed's really good out there, so I'm probably sure that, you know, people are getting high and like, oh, I need a quick pick-me-up. You know, there's all kinds of, I think people just kind of like finding a trend and researching it. And then they kind of like, there's a lot of like, when you talk about professional jobs out there, it's a lot of software people and a lot of math and engineering people. So they kind of like to learn about, you know, the nuances of something and really go with it. You know,
the technical side of whatever they're doing, whatever they're imbibing, or
that's a great way to put it. It's definitely the technical side. And I would say that extends into drinks too. I mean, it was really nice. We went to this, my sister who lives in Seattle planned this kind of get together, and we went to this bar called Percy's in Ballard. And it was so cool to go up to the bartender and just ask them to make me something random. And they do it. All the bartenders out there are pretty much trained to, you know, just be creative all the time and just come up with things. And I gave this guy a very challenging combination, but I said gin and something with gin and something creamy, which typically is very odd. But he came up with something with egg whites, and it was this fancy thing, and it was so delicious. It was like drinking a milkshake. But you know, that's really cool, and I kind of wish there was a place in New York. I understand a great cocktail menu is awesome, and I've been to cool places like PDT where the drinks are just totally on point. But it's really interesting when someone just makes you something out of the creativity
of
the moment.
New York is really into like a heavy craft bar scene right now. there, you know, the speakeasy trend, which feels like it's waning a little bit. I know that that did pass the rest of the country. Tiki's really big right now. Not really sure, you know, what's driving the trend, but like it's definitely kind of the classics in New York. It seems a little. Yeah,
New York is definitely like more of an old school. Like I've talked to a couple bartenders out here that make craft cocktails, and actually one of my friends over at PDT, I think his name's Jeff Bell. He's originally from Seattle, but he's done the whole cocktail menu there. And it kind of leads towards, like, they have a ode to, like, some of these older fashion cocktails. And I totally love the history and the culture of that, for sure. But there's definitely nothing like having somebody make you something on the spot, you know? It's like, raspberries and tequila. It's like, doesn't make sense to anyone but you, you know? But I, one thing I love about Seattle is the speakeasy trend has never waned. It's always been something huge out there. And all the speakeasy bars that we used to go to, there was Bathtub Gin, Tavern Law, the one I just told you about, Percy's. And it's really cool that those still exist. And it's, you know, kind of you hear about it, then you go in and it's got that whole secret vibe. And it's even a little more, I feel like, secret than New York. I've been to a couple out here. Well, PDT is pretty secret, but, you know, there's still windows.
What's PDT?
It's right. It's connected to Crift Dogs. So it's Please Don't Tell. I think it's in the East Village.
Yeah.
On the Lower East Side. But you should go there if you haven't.
If you guys have been to the Crift Dog on the Lower East Side, there's a phone booth.
Yes. That's PDT. Yep.
In the restaurant, and you pick up, you know, it has a whole series of secrecies that you got to go through, but I've seen people go into the booth accidentally, and then all of a sudden the back wall of the booth just like opens up, and this like beautiful girl just looks at them like, what do you want? What do you, mm-hmm. you know, get out of here. You don't belong here.
They're like, oh my God, New York is so cool. But yeah, no, I really like that place, cause I feel like that's the closest thing I can relate to the Seattle speakeasies I went to. One of actually my wife's favorite drinks when we used to go out was this, I don't remember the name of it. I don't know if you do. But it was champagne with like a little bit of Chambord and like candied hibiscus flower in it. And it's just like so simple, but it's just really kind of offhand creative, whoever came up with it. And that was like one of their big sellers. But it's just cool to have an environment like that where you have a lot of freedom, especially with the bartenders and you know, if there's a chef connected to it, just to come up with things, especially when we're talking about being sustainable. And you know, you can really, like Gramercy Tavern, you can really control your destiny as far as what you're giving the people.
I want to kind of bring the conversation back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, with oysters served on the menu and the kind of the happy hour, champagne is always an easy go-to for
champagne,
anything.
For
it just
sure.
complements every dish. But what else do you have that's like a pairing suggestion for oysters? And is it different if you're going for different regions? Because I know, like, kind of broad strokes, we were talking about Pacific Northwest, you have smaller, maybe more developed flavors,
but a bit more delicate, less
briny. The East Coast, you have the bigger size, the more briny, maybe a little less.
So basically, I would say a good lager or a Kolsch, which is kind of a... Some places have Kolsch, some don't. But it's basically the same idea as a lager, but it's a specifically, you know, produced in certain parts of Germany. But like a nice, crisp, light beer is always good. You can go for kind of a stronger beer, like maybe an IPA if the oyster is pretty mild. So you can go all the way up to like an IPA. And then, you know, dry white wine is really good. I feel like with oysters, you would never go for a mixed cocktail, just because it doesn't really do well with the tannins that are naturally in the oyster. It just kind of tastes, it doesn't taste as good as when you have something to complement it, like a white wine or a sparkling. Mm-hmm. And I would say red wine, the tannins would kind of clash with the natural tannins in the oyster. So I would say stick to beer or champagne or like a nice dry white wine.
How about rosé? Because it's about to be summer wine, summer water season.
You know, I honestly think rosé goes with everything. Not necessarily just oysters, but just emotions and stages in my life. So I feel like rosé, like a nice sparkling brut rosé, I think could go with any oyster. Especially an East Coast oyster.
Yeah.
For sure. Like the nice kind of berry flavor, but also that yeasty champagne flavor can go really well with like a nice minerally oyster.
Yeah, nice little bit of brine. I was looking at pictures on the internet. Have you had the White Girl Rosé?
No, I haven't had it, but that's hilarious.
It's the brand. It's just like a big white label with giant blue letters and it just says White Girl Rosé, which...
That's funny.
But everyone loves rosé. It's summertime.
Everybody does. Yeah.
Well, almost summertime. It's still kind of cold out. We'll be drinking rosé anyway.
You know, it's there's spots of when you're standing in the sun and it feels warm for a second, so I would call it spring. I'd call it this great 2 weeks of spring we have right before it goes right into summer.
Yeah, a hot summer.
That's the difference between the seasons here, man. In New York, it's like 2 weeks of fall, 2 weeks of spring, and everything is deathly winter and like uber hot summer.
Which reminds me, you know, just as we're wrapping up, but what about there's always that, for me, growing up, the don't eat oysters in months that don't have an R in them. Basically, that precludes oyster eating in the summertime. But, you know, Florida's hot as shit. So, and that water, like, supports bacterial growth, and that's the reason to stay away from it. Is it the same concern? Because, like, if you're in the Pacific Northwest or up on the East Coast...
You know, I've only been told that because in the summer months, they're spawning. So you might have some that have a little bit different look in their texture, which they're going to taste this, you know... They're maybe going to taste a little bit better in the winter, but... Generally, you know, in the summer when you'd want to eat oysters because it's hot out, you know, they're a little bit spawny, but I would still encourage. Yeah, like they're in the stage of like when they're going to create offspring. So they're a little bit different than normal. But I mean, if you're a novice oyster eater, you're not really going to notice.
Do you know anyone that prefers like that summer spawny kind of...
You know,
addition to their oysters?
I have
You're
not.
Shaking your head no.
I have not, but...
But for the rest of us that are oblivious, just go for it.
That may be a new food trend in the future. We never know.
Okay.
But one thing I do want to touch on with when you're talking about the Florida oysters. So that's why, you know, in the South and, you know, especially in Florida, you see a lot of the cooked and baked oysters because those ones are actually harvested for... You know, you want a big oyster when you're cooking, like Oyster Rockefeller or barbecued oysters, because, you know, the small Olympias, I mean, they would fall right through the grates. But, yeah, so that's where you get all those barbecued, delicious, cooked oysters, too.
Awesome. Oyster po' boy.
Yep.
That's the one to go
to. Fried oysters.
Yep.
The best. With some remoulade.
Awesome. Well, Kelly Jones, thank you so much for joining us on The Main Course. I appreciate you spending your time and your Easter with us. To everyone else out there, have a very happy Easter and go pick up some oysters while you're at it.
All right. Thank you, Alexis.
Happy Sunday, guys.
Happy Sunday. Happy Easter.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.